What's up, everybody? My name is Dimitri Kafinas, and you're listening to Hidden Forces, a podcast that inspires investors, entrepreneurs, and everyday citizens to challenge consensus narratives and to learn how to think critically about the systems of power shaping our world. My guest in this episode of Hidden Forces is Bob Elliott, the co-founder and CEO of Unlimited, a financial services firm that uses machine learning to create products that replicate the index returns of alternative investments. I asked Bob to come on the podcast today to help me sort through the noise of this latest news cycle as it pertains to the debt ceiling debate, regional bank stocks, the Fed's fight against inflation, and where we find ourselves in the economic cycle. I count myself among the many who have been surprised by how long it's taken for an economic recession to materialize, given the speed and extent of the Federal Reserve's rate rises. We discuss what might explain this and what it means for the Fed and investors if supply-side factors to the economy make combating inflation over the long term impossible for central banks to do without undermining their respective economies' abilities to invest in the very infrastructure and services needed to ameliorate it. It's an excellent overview of where we find ourselves today and provides an especially useful framework for thinking about the important issues facing the economy and markets over the next 6 to 12 months. You can find related podcasts to this one on this week's episode page at hiddenforces.io, where you can also access our premium content, including transcripts, intelligence reports, and key takeaway videos, by going to hiddenforces.io/subscribe. All of our content tiers give you access to our premium feed, which you can listen to on your mobile device using your favorite podcast app, just like you're listening to this episode right now. If you want to join in on the conversation, become a member of the Hidden Forces Genius community, which includes Q&A calls with guests, access to special research and analysis, in-person events, and dinners. You can also do that on our subscriber page. And if you still have questions, feel free to send an email to info@hiddenforces.io, and I or someone from our team will get right back to you. Lastly, because this conversation deals with investing, I want to make absolutely clear that nothing I say on this podcast can or should be viewed as financial advice. All opinions expressed by me and my guest are solely our own opinions and should not be relied upon as the basis for financial decisions. And with that, please enjoy this excellent conversation with my guest, Bob Elliott. Bob Elliott, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Thanks so much for having me. Really excited to be on.
It's great having you on, Bob. You've done everybody else's podcast and TV show except for mine. So you're long overdue.
Well, I saved the best for last.
I like that. I like the way you put that. So, Bob, before we get into the subject of today's conversation, I would love for you to tell me and my listeners, for the one person out there who actually hasn't heard an appearance of yours anywhere else or doesn't know who you are, tell us a little bit about who you are and your firm, Unlimited, and what you guys do.
Yeah, my career has been about 20 years as a systematic macro investor. I was at Bridgewater Associates for almost 15 years, which is the world's largest hedge fund, where I developed a number of the strategies that were in the flagship Pure Alpha Fund and served on the investment committee, as well as running the founder Ray Dalio's personal investment research team for a long time. And so really sort of built my career around that sort of deep macro understanding of how the world works and how to take that understanding and translate it into, you know, trading and investing across different asset classes. I left in 2018 as Bridgewater had grown and I wanted to get back to something more entrepreneurial. And after a few years of sort of working on some ideas, came to this idea about Unlimited, which the basic idea is that hedge funds and other 2 in 20 asset managers, 2 in 20 being the typical fee structure of funds like private equity and venture capital and hedge funds, you know, those managers are pretty good at generating very good returns, but they're also pretty good at charging high fees, which means that many investors aren't that much better off than they would be on their own. And so we got to thinking about whether there was a way to build technology based upon our extensive experience and modern machine learning approaches that would allow us to replicate what these 2 and 20 managers are doing and put them into a package that was much more investor friendly than traditional LP structures like ETFs. And so that's really what Unlimited is all about, which is diversified 2 and 20 index ETFs at a much lower cost structure and available to all investors. We started our first, we've only been around for a little over a year, which has been quite the year. We launched our first product, the HFND ETF, in October of 2022. It was the fastest growing independent actively managed ETF launch of the year. Very, you know, very tough time to issue a new financial product. And we were lucky to be very successful connecting with a lot of independent advisors as well as individual investors on what we were doing. And now we're looking to build out a whole suite of products that are around this idea of 2 and 20 replications for the everyday investor.
So one of the things I was telling you before we started this recording was that, you know, again, the Hidden Forces podcast is we range pretty widely here. We don't focus just on markets. We focus on all sorts of stuff. And the last time we really did episodes on the market and the economy were back in March with SVB. And, you know, I just wanted to make sure that we covered it and sort of gave investors and the public a sense of what was going on and what some of the drivers were. But for the most part, I feel like what drove the failure of SVB, much of that was stuff that we'd already been talking about. And in the months since, not much has changed from my perspective, at least. And I felt like most of what we just see is the typical sort of background noise of media and podcasts like mine trying to find things to talk about. And I didn't want to necessarily contribute to that. And so I would love for you to maybe give me a sense of the economic picture, not just a snapshot of where you think we are, but really a rolling dynamic sense of where we are in this cycle and what the underlying forces are that are driving those dynamics that you think we should be paying attention to.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing to think about, which I think aligns with your intuition, is that what we're in right now is a very typical macroeconomic cycle. And most of us actually in our professional careers haven't seen a typical macroeconomic cycle, particularly a late cycle dynamic leading into an eventual downturn. Because most of us in our professional careers have seen COVID, which obviously is an unusual circumstance, and the acute financial crisis that came with 2008. And so the result is many people have in their minds this idea that financial downturns move very quickly. Right? That what happens is there's a series of cascading events that eventually create an acute slowdown, which are met by relatively stimulative monetary policy. And so that's not the case for typical macroeconomic cycles. You can kind of think about macroeconomic cycles like, you know, there's a big freighter moving through the ocean. And the Fed is like throwing one anchor after another, trying to slow down this freighter and get it to finally get into reverse. And it takes a lot of effort to get there, and it takes years to play out, right? The typical macroeconomic cycle from the point of, you know, the beginning of a meaningful tightening to the point in which, for instance, the unemployment rate peaks can be 3, 4, 5 years. Now, that's pretty inconsistent. That slow-moving cycle is pretty inconsistent with, let's say, an increasingly fast-moving media looking, hanging on every word. Right. And so in that cycle, basically what we're at here is that, sure, people know there's been a lot of, you know, we had relatively strong economic growth, elevated inflation. The Fed tightened a lot. The Fed continued or accelerated QT. That's been in place. You know, that series of tightenings have been in place for about a year. What we're starting to see is the beginning signs of the chinks in the armor of the economy. Slowly but surely, we're starting to see a little bit of softening. But, you know, what we haven't seen is we haven't seen a meaningful slowing of employment. We haven't seen a meaningful, while inflation has come down a little bit from peak, it's come down from peak. We're seeing a stabilization in the range of, you know, roughly 5%. And so that whole picture is one where there's still more work to be done to eventually get to a point where the economy has slowed enough such that inflation starts to moderate enough such that the Fed can tip into an easing cycle. But we're talking about a pace or a process that's going to play out over 6, 12, 18 months, not one that's going to play out over the course of weeks.
Do you think this cycle has taken longer and the recession has taken longer to materialize than many people expected? And if so, why?
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that this cycle has taken a lot longer than most people expected. As an example, you know, something like 80% of professional economists were expecting in the first quarter for us to enter recession. But instead, the unemployment rate has continued to fall and nominal final sales growth was, you know, 7.5%. So, you know, nothing that looks like a recession happened in the first quarter. And the reason why that is I think because most of us who are professional economists, let's say, in one form or another, as well as traders, really have built our careers understanding credit cycles. And so very focused on how credit cycles play out, which are very sensitive to monetary policy, tightening, and interest rates. But the cycle that we're seeing today is a very different cycle. What I describe as it's an unfamiliar cycle, not an unusual cycle, but unfamiliar to most people. What we're seeing today is an income-driven cycle. So what happened was we saw a significant amount of fiscal stimulation coming out of COVID. We saw supply shocks. That then created, the combination of those things created elevated prices. And then because the labor market was relatively tight, people were able to negotiate for higher wages and we started to see relatively significant wage growth occurring. And so if you put that together, what we're seeing today is that wage growth of 5, 6, 7%, depending on exactly how you measure it, that's what's keeping nominal spending going, not credit. In fact, credit basically hasn't been anywhere near as influential since the financial crisis, right? If we remember, we borrowed a ton of money in 2005 and 6 and 7 and 8, and that created the financial crisis. But today, most households have much less debt on their balance sheets. Corporations have much less debt. Their interest, their debt burdens are much lower than they were back in the 2005 to 8 cycle. And so this is much more about income growth. And because income growth is a very durable thing. You don't get a slowdown in income growth until you get a weakening of demand, which leads to weakening of earnings, which leads to a weakening of labor markets, which leads to the weakening of employment and income growth and spending, right? That's the cycle. In that cycle, we're actually pretty early in that cycle, not relatively advanced in that cycle, despite the significant monetary policy tightening.
So does that explain why the Fed was able to get away with so many rate hikes and we didn't see the expected effect on the economy as quickly as people were looking for because it's an income-driven versus a credit-driven cycle?
That's exactly right. Like what you had in terms of credit growth, even coming into this cycle, because so much of the expansion was financed by fiscal stimulation coming out of COVID, right? That didn't require households to borrow a bunch of money in order to increase their demand, right? Because corporations were earning high nominal earnings, it didn't require them to borrow a bunch of money to do a bunch of investment. And so all of those things, those dynamics created what can be a reasonably self-reinforcing process that where you have an elevated nominal spending financed by fiscal expansion, which happened just after COVID and during COVID, which then leads to elevated employment, which then leads to the higher income growth. Right. And because one person's spending is another person's income, if nominal income growth and nominal spending growth remains strong, it then supports others' incomes, which then supports their nominal spending. And so you can have this maintenance, this reinforcing dynamic where elevated wages lead to elevated spending, which then lead to elevated wage growth. And that's exactly the cycle that we're in right now.
So one area where we have seen rising interest rates and shrinking liquidity have an effect has been with regional banks. And again, this is something that we covered with Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank back in our episode with Stephen Kelly. And one of the systemic explanations for those failures had to do with this duration mismatch between the short-term cost of funding, which has gone up alongside the Fed's aggressive rate hiking cycle, and the long-term duration risk exposure that a bank like SVB had, who bought ultra safe assets like US Treasuries, but did so at much lower yields. And so they were sitting on substantial unrealized losses that wouldn't necessarily have been a problem if not for the deposit flight, which is ultimately what killed SVB. As a result of these failures, a much larger narrative took hold, which said that this was not just unique to banks like SVB or Signature, and that we could expect to see more regional banks fail along similar lines. my question for you is, what is, in your view, the reality versus the perception around this story? And how much of this is actually also being driven by depositors moving their money out of banks and into money market funds, again, because of the higher yields that are now available to them?
Yeah, what we're seeing with the main challenges we're seeing with the regional banks are related to bank runs. And I think it's really important to distinguish at this time the difference between what has been described as a bank walk versus a bank run. So it's very normal that you see in an economic cycle where interest rates are raised and bank deposit rates don't generally keep up with short-term interest rates, like interest rates on T-bills, which then inspires a certain subset of depositors to take their money and move it from the banking system over to money market funds in order to earn a higher yield. That, in fact, has been going on for the last 18 months or so, you know, since interest rates started to rise, and it's been continuing at a relatively modest pace. And most of those losses have occurred in the biggest banks in the U.S., and most of those losses have been desirable for the biggest banks in the U.S. And the reason why that is because you can tell why that is because those banks haven't raised their deposit rates, right? So if you're losing deposits in a 5% short rate regime and you continue to offer your deposit yield at 0%, it's not a deposit flight, it's a deposit choice. You're choosing to lose those deposits. And most of those banks are paying off those deposits using cash that was built up during the significant quantitative easing period. And so that whole cycle, frankly, is not that interesting. Like, it's a very normal cycle. It happens. It's not that disruptive. It's not that interesting. The more interesting question and the more acute question is the nature of these bank runs. And I think these bank runs, what we've seen is we've seen a real transition. You know, initially, the dynamic was as you describe, which is this concern about mark-to-market assets because interest rates have risen and many of those assets were bought at low interest rates. The mark-to-market aspect of that is one in which if the bank had to pay off all the depositors in a short period of time, the bank wouldn't have had enough assets at their disposal in order to pay off those depositors. To be clear, it's the nature of banking to borrow short and lend long. And any bank that experiences a bank run is not going to have sufficient resources to pay off their depositors because that's fundamentally the nature of the banking business. I think what we've seen, which has been very interesting, is after the SVB circumstance happened, the Fed came in and said, in order to take this mark-to-market accounting issue off the table for treasury bonds and agency bonds, what we'll do is we'll lend at 100% par against those bonds using a new program. And that's a very important program because it means, you know, treasury bonds get paid in full no matter what. That's all there is to it, right? They're money good at par at the time in which they come due. And so what the Fed did is said, let's forget about the mark-to-market accounting. Let's forget about the mark-to-market situation. You can redeem those bonds at 100%. That way, no one should be worried about the mark-to-market aspects of risk-free securities. That was important, and that created a significant stabilization across the regional banks. I think what we've seen in recent times, which I'm sure some of your listeners have been following, dynamics like what has happened to PacWest or Western Alliance, that's been a very different dynamic. Those banks have experienced significant pressure, not from deposit losses. If anything, their deposits have actually risen since the SVB circumstance, right? They saw an immediate hit and then they've seen those deposits rising. The dynamic that we've seen with those banks is a totally different dynamic where equity speculation, short selling, put pressure, et cetera, on these banks that have relatively tiny market caps, like $1 billion or $2 billion, have created stock market declines that have then created a pressure, a concern from depositors who have then pulled their money out. And you can see that actually very concretely in how the PacWest dynamic played out recently, which is following the resolution of First Republic, the stock fell something like 75%. But during that time, during that fall, deposits were flat. And only after the 75% decline in the stock did you start to see some deposit flight. And so we're seeing a speculative-driven attack on the equity prices, which is engendering a deposit run, which is a totally different dynamic than what we saw during the SVB cycle.
Hmm. So it goes from the dog wagging its tail to the tail wagging the dog as the speculators become concerned or see an opportunity to profit from it. Is it largely that, the latter, in other words, speculators seeing an opportunity to pile in, that's driving this? Or is it mostly now just the self-fulfilling prophecy of market participants who are anticipating that this is a dynamic that will continue, and so they just want to get ahead of the trade anyway?
Well, I think that's a really important, the idea of a self-fulfilling prophecy with stock prices when it comes to banks, I think it's like a really important concept, which is it's very different from a typical company. So as an example, if you just thought about Coca-Cola, if Coca-Cola's stock prices went down 50% tomorrow, you as a consumer would not care, right? You'd just drink as much Coke as you were interested in drinking, right? And that
you'd have to probably drink more. Like Warren Buffett says, if I like hamburgers, the price goes down. I like them more. I eat more hamburgers.
Right. Exactly. And so I think like that's a good example where the stock price in a typical non-financial company doesn't really influence the day-to-day operational execution and success of the company. And so to the extent that there's, you know, people who think that it should be a lower price relative to people who think it should be a higher price, we have transfers against, you know, basically it's like transferring money between, you know, one side and the other of people who are, you know, either long or short the particular stock. Banks are very different because the stock price can influence the viability of the company itself. And that's a very different dynamic because what it means is that you can, and folks essentially have with PacWest, created a bank run by selling short the securities, by going short the securities. And to be clear, these banks, like just orders of magnitude, PacWest is like a $1 billion market cap bank. Like a relatively moderately sized hedge fund could break PacWest. And in fact, that's what it looks like is basically happening. And so it doesn't take that much capital to sell the stock, which then, of course, confidence starts to get eroded if you see that your bank's stock is down, you know, 75% and might go into resolution. Then you start to get concerned as an uninsured depositor and start to think about taking your money out, which then reinforces the problem. And I think the thing that's very different here with banks as opposed to typical non-financial companies is if the speculators engender a run, the transfer is not between primarily previous holders of the stock and existing shorts, the way it would be for a non-financial company. The transfer then becomes between the American taxpayers and the shorts, right? Because eventually, if a bank gets driven into resolution, the elimination of the franchise value often, basically always, creates a negative effect on the bank itself, which means that the FDIC has to come in and essentially, you know, offer good terms for someone to pick up the balance sheet of the bank that's in resolution. And the people who pay for that are the taxpayers of the US, right? And so what we have here is we have a set of speculative shorts that are driving against these banks, looking for the next weak hand, which is then creating the problem. And the people who will pay for it is, you know, basically is the taxpayer. The taxpayer pays for the outcome here if these banks get driven into resolution.
Yeah, and that, you know, that may also be assuming that it's not just the FDIC and the $250,000 deposit limit, but that in fact all deposits are now de facto insured because of the SVB bailout. Do you think that in order to resolve this or bring an end to it, that the government needs to guarantee all deposits at this point?
Yeah, I think the challenge with the regulatory response right now is it's actually constrained by the Dodd-Frank laws that were implemented following the financial crisis. In the financial crisis, very interesting for those who weren't following closely at the time, there were essentially no bank runs. And the reason why there were no bank runs was because the Fed and the Treasury and the FDIC implemented a program that guaranteed all transaction deposits. So anything that wasn't a CD, you know, basically was guaranteed. And so as a result, people didn't move their money out of the banks meaningfully, and there wasn't significant bank runs, despite the fact that there was way worse balance sheet conditions for banks back then.
Well, they also recapitalized a lot of these banks in real time. I think TARP was repurposed, wasn't it, from buying troubled assets to actually buying the equity of some of these banks?
Yeah, the timing matters a lot. In October, there was a guarantee. You know, Lehman failed in September, which was really the beginning of the acute financial crisis. About 3 weeks later, the Fed, Treasury, and FDIC guaranteed all deposits. And then it wasn't until basically March where there was a recapitalization of the banks. Mm. And, you know, we started to see a bottoming and moving forward using TARP. And so I think that's an important dynamic because the way the subsequent legislation, which was the Dodd-Frank Act, basically forced congressional agreement in order to change the deposit protection limits. And so right now, the only way that the Fed and the FDIC can make depositors whole is if banks go into resolution. They have to first fail, and then depositors can be protected, which is different because it means that basically you have to lose the franchise value and pay the gap. The FDIC has to pay the gap to resolve the bank in order to actually protect the depositors. And so I think the big problem right now is that we don't have a proactive strategy creating a guarantee of deposits ahead of resolution because it would require essentially a bipartisan act of Congress in order to put that into place. And without those legislators acting, you know, and bipartisanship is certainly a challenging dynamic on any topic. And this, you know, certainly one as nuanced as this, it's very challenging. And so that means that we're probably likely to see this dynamic continue to play out for a little while until it becomes so painful that it inspires congressional authorities to actually get their act together and implement changes in the deposit regime that will help stem the risk of this self-reinforcing bank run dynamic.
So we've been in environments before where the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates pretty dramatically, but I guess you'd probably have to go back to the early 80s to see that. But we haven't had a world of like online digital banking where people can easily move their money from bank to bank or also move it from deposit accounts at a bank to money market funds. Does the latter in particular expose a kind of flaw in the limited deposit insurance regime that currently exists today?
Yeah, I think there's a combination of problems with the existing deposit regime. The first is that it hasn't been updated in 15 years, you know, and we've had a lot of changes in the last 15 years, just like the nominal value of bank deposits has gone up considerably over that period of time. So whereas, you know, if you go back 30 or 40 years, something like 90% of bank deposits were insured using the FDIC guarantees. Today, it's under 50%. Okay, so that's a big, significant change. And just keeping a regulatory infrastructure that is in the same ballpark as what we've had structurally through history would require relatively significant change in terms of upping the limit to 1 million, 2 million, 2.5 million, something like that. Okay, so that's the first step, is it's just an outdated infrastructure. Mm-hmm. The second step, which I think is very important, is this ability to more quickly move money out of the banking system and also a quicker environment in which information about the banking system is distributed. Like, let's be honest, you know, SVB failed in 48 hours, right? Like that's how long it took to fail. If it had just been the sort of bank walk it had experienced up until that 48 hours, it would have been fine. It wouldn't have been a great bank. It wouldn't have been that profitable. It would have just kind of like plodded along as like a bad company, but not a bank failure. But the fact that you could in 48 hours change the whole, you know, basically pull out your deposits and move it into a different bank, and that information about the bank and essentially inspiring the bank run could be distributed so quickly through things like Twitter and other things, private chats amongst venture capitalists and things like that, you know, meant that you could put a lot of pressure on a bank in a way that would, you know, typically a bank run would take months to play out. And then here it took hours to play out. And so I think that that's a very important dynamic, but it shouldn't be confused. The fact that you can move your money from your Bank of America account over to a money market fund and that the frictions on that are lower today than they were before, that's a bank walk dynamic. Banks are totally prepared for bank walks. If anything, they, for a variety of regulatory reasons, might actually prefer to lower the amount of deposits they have. So everyone's fine with a bank walk. The problem is the bank run, because no bank, no matter how well capitalized, no matter how good the assets are, no bank can survive a bank run. And that's what we're seeing. That's the problem that we have today.
How much of a problem is it also that there's a kind of two-tier banking system, which is that the too-big-to-fail banks are implicitly, there's a sense in which all your deposits are insured if you have them at JP Morgan, whereas that's not the case if you have it at some local, you know, small regional bank.
Yeah, that's certainly an important consideration here, where it isn't constructive for the risks that exist for the regional banks and the small banks to have a circumstance in which, you know, essentially one set of institutions and their depositors are prioritized over another set of institutions and their depositors. And so, you know, part of that circumstance, or basically the circumstance that we're seeing right now, is a function of also that inefficiency in the mm-hmm. regulatory regime. And so, but which could be easily resolved by raising the deposit limit, which would basically make depositors more on par, whether they're holding their money at JP Morgan or whether they're holding it at PacWest, right? That, like, that's the solution. The solution to the problem is to raise the deposit guarantee limit, because it then means that you are indifferent between holding your assets at one bank versus another.
So let's talk a little bit about what investors might be missing, because everyone's been focused on regional banks. But the one thing that we can all agree on is that the most fundamental dynamic that's led to this, quote, crisis in regional banking has been the rising interest rate environment. So that has as you said, if you compare an income-driven cycle versus a credit-driven cycle, income-driven cycles are less interest rate sensitive, but there are interest rate sensitive parts of the economy. And so, you know, we've heard a lot about commercial real estate, and there are knock-on effects as well, again, bringing us back to regional banking. But what other areas of the market are particularly vulnerable to this type of environment that maybe people aren't talking about? For example, like the market for private credit, lenders that have picked up the slack as a result of Dodd-Frank and changes since the 2008 financial crisis. So, like, what are you keeping your eyes on, and what do you think isn't getting enough attention that should be?
I think the biggest thing that's not getting enough attention is, which is kind of counterintuitive, is that there has been a big transformational change in the economy following the financial crisis that significantly reduced the amount of leverage in the system amongst financial intermediaries. And so the result is that a lot more of the credit problems are held by less levered institutions and structures than existed before the financial crisis, which means that you can absorb a lot more economic pain through those structures without creating more acute knock-on impacts. And so, as an example, you know, I think a nice example is like the BREIT, right? Which is, back in the financial crisis, the way that that worked was banks held first loss tranches of real estate securities, which were effective, you know, held on 30 times leverage, right? Mm. That's what the structure of, and that's what caused the financial crisis. You know, today, pension funds, university endowments hold BREIT, which is, you know, which is losing money, right? Definitely, there's no question, right? Slowly but surely, that's getting repriced. The structure itself has about 2x leverage in it, you know, which is something, but way less than 30 times. So you can absorb a lot more equity losses. Mm-hmm. And the people who are on the other side of that structure are things like pension funds, university endowments, you know, things like that, which are unlevered investors who lent the money, who basically purchased those shares in the structure, and who can absorb losses and do absorb losses all the time, right? Like, you know, if you're a public pension fund with a 60-40 allocation mix, like, stocks go down 20% all the time, and, you know, the pension fund isn't ruined, it's fine. Like, over time, there's a bit, you know, some more accrual that has to happen from your pensioners. But, you know, it's not that big a deal in terms of creating an acute financial crisis. And so I think a big part of the transformation of the economy that we've seen is basically this deleveraging of all the different structures, all the different players, all the different things. And so what that has created is kind of like this grind. Kind of everyone's looking around and saying, where's the acute? And the answer is, it's probably not there. I mean, even this regional banking thing, like, once you resolve the mark to market on the treasury and agency bonds, which were all the time money good, right? Like, what fundamental issue is there really left? Like, some office buildings that represent, you know, 10% of the CRE market, which is only, you know, a small portion of their overall book. Like, it's just, you can keep trying to find the next great thing that's going to spark the grand crisis in deleveraging. And I think the big story is, no, that's not how this is playing out. This is playing out much closer akin to a cycle in the 50s and 60s than it is playing out akin to a cycle like the 2005 to 8 cycle.
So in that case, let's talk about the debt ceiling, because there are sort of two, I guess, obvious concerns about the debt ceiling if you ascribe to the theory that, you know, maybe they don't raise the debt ceiling. And there are phases of that that can impact. So one is the concern about the Treasury market, but the other is the concern about government spending as the government, you know, enacts measures in order to prioritize paying the debt, which would have an effect on income and this income-driven cycle. So I'm curious to understand what your view is of the debt ceiling negotiations. How much of this is just typical media cycle, just needing to talk about something, versus actually, like, what is substantive? And then there, like, what are the mechanics that are relevant here? And what risks are you concerned about as relate to the debt ceiling?
Well, the debt ceiling is, in some ways, you can almost think about the debt ceiling as like an orthogonal dynamic that's going on that's sort of unrelated to the underlying macroeconomic strength or cyclical
in and of itself.
Right. And so I think what we're seeing with the debt ceiling, and I think you get really, the debt ceiling is one of those tail risks that requires a great deal of understanding on the small chance that it becomes an actual issue. But important to remember that odds are that, you know, much more likely that we stand September 1st with the debt ceiling resolved and all that stuff being in the background rather than being in the foreground of what's going on. I think the big picture is that, you know, essentially, there will be a resolution of the debt ceiling. It will probably come before, but it may not come before we get to the X date, which is the point in which the Treasury no longer can issue debt. The resolution of the debt ceiling will be a trade like it was back more than 10 years ago between fiscal cuts in order to raise the, you know, a trade of fiscal cuts in order to raise the debt ceiling in one form or another. Those fiscal cuts actually matter a fair amount, how exactly that nets out. I think people who are close to the politics of this are seeing things like maybe a 50 or 75 basis point GDP impact from the cuts that would come from the agreed upon debt ceiling rise. You know, that's still a lot up in the air today, but you know, something like a 50 or 75 basis point real GDP drag from fiscal contraction would be a meaningful hit to the economy that would start to see itself flow through in the fourth quarter and early in 2024. So I think that's a real possibility. And that's the sort of stuff that, you know, strategically you should be thinking about. And then there's the tactical dynamics about what's going on with the debt ceiling, which, you know, are more nuanced, but the gist of which is that the U.S. will not default. People who say that the U.S. will default don't know what they're talking about. The main problem with hitting the X date and no longer being able to issue incremental debt is that what it forces is the U.S. government to bring spending in line with the earned income on an ongoing basis. What that means is, you know, the U.S. is currently running a deficit of something like 5-7% of GDP. They would probably have to fully close that deficit, and because you'd have to constrain yourself to make sure that you don't run afoul on a month-to-month basis, it would probably be more like a 10% of GDP fiscal contraction that would occur over a very short time frame. That would give the federal government plenty of room to pay debt service on the existing debt and continue to roll the stock of existing bonds. The Fed and Treasury have extensively worked out a plan to engage in this prioritization. They talked about it extensively in congressional testimony. They've run simulations. They're ready to go. Private conversations with people that I've had with people very close to the matter know exactly what they're doing and will execute it effectively. So there will not be a default. But that 10%, even if in a short term, a 10% of GDP fiscal contraction would be a heck of a drag on the economy, right? Mm-hmm. And so that could create, you know, a relatively acute short-term downward pressure on the economy. You know, if it lasts for a day, it won't matter. If it lasts for 3 months, though, it could be, you know, a meaningful problem. And I think one of the challenges is the fact that the Fed and the Treasury could easily continue to pay the debt service even after the X date might prolong the negotiations, because there might you wouldn't feel an immediate effect on the financial markets or the economy, but you would feel that pressure over time as people don't get their Social Security checks or the Army doesn't get paid and things like that. But that takes time. And so it could actually create a lengthening of this process. Mm. The prudence might create a lengthening of this process relative to, you know, a more acute circumstance.
Am I right in thinking that this could actually have more of effect on prices and inflation and economic growth than the monetary measures taken so far, in the same way that the COVID stimulus and government spending had an effect in the other direction?
Yeah, I think that's a good insight. What's the Fed trying to do right now? They're trying to slow down the economy, right? The economy is too strong and inflation is too high relative to their target. And so what they're doing is they're using the only levers that they have available, which is raising interest rates and quantitative tightening. And those levers are not particularly effective. And to be clear, it shouldn't be that surprising that they aren't that effective, because they weren't that effective in stimulating the economy back for 10 years following the financial crisis, right? The thing that is always effective, always more effective, is fiscal policy, because it's relatively direct. And in the same way, when we engaged a whole bunch of COVID-related stimulus, it was very supportive to the economy, so too would a meaningful fiscal contraction be pretty directly detrimental to the economy, right? Slowing the economy. And so in some ways, I think what we might find ourselves in is, we might find ourselves, if we're standing, I don't know, 9 months from today, we might say to ourselves, well, the Fed really tried their best, but it didn't really do much. But the combination of the debt ceiling negotiations with some of the COVID era programs starting to roll off, like a restart of payments of student loans, some SNAP specific payments starting to roll down, things like that, all created enough of a fiscal contraction that started to slow the economy enough, that started to weaken the labor market, that started to create, you know, this self-reinforcing cycle that eventually brought down inflation. And it was the fiscal lever, which ultimately was much more effective and will be much more effective than the monetary lever ever was.
So what does all this mean for investors? And I guess let's begin with what it means for interest rates, because I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think the market is priced in 3 or 4 cuts before the end of the year. How do those projections line up with your own expectations? Are we going to get those cuts? And what does it mean for the market if it's forecasting a pivot that never actually materializes?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is you've got to look at what's going on with macroeconomic conditions and think about those conditions in the context of what the Fed's, what's called a reaction function, which is basically when the Fed sees a certain set of data, how do they respond to that certain set of data? I think it's really important, whether you like it or not, the Fed is responding to the data that they see, not the information that they think or the dynamics that they think will play out. And the part of the reason is because that's institutionally how it's structured. And part of the reason is they tried to be predictive with the whole transitory inflation thing.
It did not work very well for them.
And that was, yeah, they were dead wrong on that.
Do you think that they've lost confidence in their ability to forecast inflation, which has made them more biased towards going higher for longer than they would have otherwise coming into this cycle?
Yeah, I think they, in general, the Fed has taken a relatively conservative view around trying to predict how things will play out and then using that to influence their monetary policy. And Chairman Powell really took an unusual bet on the fact that inflation would be transitory and learned their lesson, because they were dead wrong. I mean, part of that is because their prediction was very wrong, but also part of it was they got a little unlucky because the Ukraine war created a circumstance where there was another inflationary impulse that they probabilistically couldn't have imagined when they were sitting there thinking and navigating it based upon it being transitory. But I think they've basically given up. Like, they're not using predictive ability in order to guide their influence or guide their decisions. And so they're looking at the data that's coming in. And so just very bluntly, the data that's come in is like core inflation over the last 6 months has been at 5% and flat. The unemployment rate's at secular lows. And that combination of things means that they need to maintain relatively tight monetary policy. If anything, it might indicate that they should continue to tighten monetary policy. And so if you think about that reaction function and the data that they need to see, and they probably need to see between 3 and 6 months of data showing meaningful declines in inflation or very significant rises in unemployment before they would change their existing policy stances. And so if you think about that, like, what are the odds that they see 3 to 6 months of data of meaningful declines in inflation by December? Well, I mean, it's already May, right? Like, it's going to take, how are they possibly going to get enough data to affirm that number of cuts by that time? I think it's very improbable. It's not impossible. We could have a financial crisis or something like that. But if you're looking at the macro stats, very improbable that they deliver the cuts that are currently priced in.
So I diverted us from my original question. I do want to get back to it, but I want to, I have a follow-up question on what you said. So you said that they were, I don't know, you used some qualifiers, like very wrong on the transitory narrative. But I want to, not necessarily because I disagree with you, but I want to push back and challenge you on that and see if this makes sense. How do we know that they were, quote, wrong on the transitory narrative and not just really early on it, like so many other people have been calling the recession early? In other words, how much of the downward trending movement that we've seen started to see in inflation was going to happen anyway, regardless of Fed policy? And, you know, furthermore, how much stock should we really be putting in some of these lagging indicators that the Fed looks at rather than many of the leading indicators, which have been pointing increasingly towards recession?
Yeah, I think when it comes to inflation, I think the main point of the initial transitory narrative was that the rise in prices related to supply shocks would not ultimately translate into increasing wage demands, which would then lead to income-driven expansion. And I think on that point, it is unambiguous that the Fed got that wrong, right? There's been all sorts of circumstances where we've had transitory inflation, like, I don't know, if you go back to the 90s with the first Iraq war invasion. That's a good example, right? Where oil prices spiked, there was a relatively acute rise in gasoline prices, but you look around and you say, well, no one demanded higher wages. It then came down, wages didn't change, and we all kind of moved on with our lives, right? And so I think in many ways, that is the test, is did it translate to wage growth in the same way? You know, I think you can look at, is it translating the inflationary pressures, whether you're looking at Europe or the UK, and to some extent starting to emerge in Japan, what you see is that once you get that translation to wages, that creates the reinforcing. It doesn't necessarily mean going up. It just means it reinforces the dynamic of the elevated
inflation expectations being embedded in the
wages.
And the wages of workers.
And that's the real pickle, which is it's pretty tough. Like once people start to expect wage growth of, you know, 5% and it starts to get written into contracts and et cetera, that it's a phenomenon, right? It's not just a price in a moment. It's a phenomenon that has life to it. And so that's why, frankly, it was so important for them. That's why you want to get ahead of the inflation phenomenon, because every day that inflation persists longer and longer, it starts to become further and further entrenched. And I think what we're starting to see is a real risk of entrenchment in the economy. And what progress they have made on inflation, frankly, I'd say they've experienced transitory disinflation. And the reason why that is because the reason why inflation on, like, on a year-over-year basis has come down considerably over the last, you know, six plus months is because there's been big disinflation from gas prices supported by unsustainable declines in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And there's been a big decline in certain prices. There was a big decline in certain prices as supply chain shocks got resolved. So we had supply chain shocks, prices go up, supply chain shocks get resolved, prices go down. But now we're seeing prices start to resettle back at a higher level, which means overall inflation is starting to get back to that sort of structural level. Overall inflation remains at that structural level, which is where it's basically the structural inflation level is the difference between the nominal wage growth in the economy and the productive capacity growth in the economy. That is the difference. And what we see is that, you know, individual wages are rising at 5 or 6%. Productivity on the economy in aggregate is close to zero, right? And so that's the gap. That's the gap that we're seeing. And that's why we're seeing the inflation that we're seeing.
So does that mean that for the long term, for inflation to fall sustainably, that more capital needs to be invested in those parts of the economy which have been experiencing shortages and or have seen underinvestment, like the oil and gas space? And is there a role for the government to play in helping to incentivize those investments? In other words, long-term, aren't we really talking about a supply problem here, not a demand problem, which the Fed has been trying to solve with its interest rate hikes?
Well, I think the long-term dynamics around supply constraints are persistent and important. And the reason why that is that there's sort of a couple of different factors that are intersecting that are creating structural supply constraints. There are, of course, tactical supply constraints around COVID, which basically happened and then have mostly been reversed. But these structural supply constraints really, you know, are two forms. One very important form is that, you know, for a long time, for most of our professional careers, from 1994 until 2020, durable goods prices fell on average a couple percent a year, right? And so it was almost so insipid, we don't even remember that this is how it worked. And the reason why durable goods prices were able to fall was because it was an era of globalization. Basically, you had hundreds of millions of people in East Asia moving from the farm to the factory, and you had a massive supply wave in terms of labor coming into the global economy that created those structural disinflationary pressures that were supported by increased globalization links in all sorts of forms. Well, that even before the sort of global geopolitical tensions between the West and the East, those dynamics were starting to reverse. And then these additional pressures, these additional tensions, let's say, between the US and China, only exacerbate the delinking of those economies. Huh. And the reversal, you know, just going from big deflationary force to flat would create an inflationary impulse in the economy. If we started to see globalization reverse and the need to create friendshoring and duplicate supply chains and all that stuff related to the geopolitical issues, that would be a really big deal that over time could create a structural inflationary pressure that is as big as the disinflationary pressures that most of us have known through our careers. That's a big structural dynamic. Then there's a more tactical dynamic in the United States, which is that, you know, labor force growth has slowed considerably. Like if you go back to 2008 or the 2000 cycle, labor force growth was at 1%, 2%, above 2%, right? Combination of immigration plus natural, you know, domestic labor force growth. Well, today it's pretty close to zero, you know, slightly positive. And the significant constraint on immigration in the economy, I'm not making a political statement, just a factual macroeconomic point, that the combination of aging of the employment base, the domestic employment base, with reduced immigration, you put those two things together, and we then additionally have a domestic supply shock when it comes to labor, which adds further pressure to this global supply shock in, you know, global reversal of disinflationary pressures. And you put those things together, and that dynamic is combining to line up for likely an era, a more structural era of inflation, which is very different from the structural era of disinflation that basically all of us have known for our entire lives.
Perfect. So I'm going to tack that onto my closing question, which I asked before, and I'm going to ask it again. So my question before was a couple questions ago, which was, what does all this mean for investors? And what I was really asking was kind of, what do all the things that we're dealing with now mean for investors over the immediate horizon, over the next year or so or 2 years? But let's tack onto that long term, because if we are going to move into a structurally inflationary environment where it's going to be difficult for central banks to get inflation down, what does that also mean long-term for investors, and where the opportunities are really going to be, in your view?
Yeah, I think most investors really need to change their framework in terms of how they think about how to strategically save, invest, and build wealth over time. Like most investors, what have they experienced? Well, most of them experienced the success of 60/40, right, which was meaningfully supported by an era of disinflation for the last 40 years. And then further incentives to buy the highest beta, which was supported by 15 years of the easiest monetary and fiscal policy that has existed in modern finance, right? And so if you were standing really up until a year ago, right, if you were standing January 1st, 2022, what were your biggest lessons for how to invest money, which is, invest in 60/40 because bonds will be an important diversifying
asset. We're also doing well because interest rates were dropping consistently.
Right, right. But number two, buy the riskiest stuff because it pays out the best. Because I look the smartest if I buy the riskiest stuff. Well, as we transition from a world of unbridled monetary stimulation to tighter monetary policy, and we transition from a world of structural disinflation to structural inflationary pressures, the lessons learned over the course of the last 20, 30 years are not going to be applicable. If anything, they will be misguided in terms of how to navigate the next 5, 10, 20 years. And so what investors have to do is they have to go back and look at scenarios that are closer akin to the dynamics that we're seeing today, dynamics like the 60s and the 70s, which give insight into how to protect themselves from an era of structural inflation. Because for investors, particularly savers, right? I'm not talking about tactical investors, I'm talking about long-term savers. The thing that is the biggest risk is not that stocks fall 20% or something like that. The thing that's the biggest risk is we move to an era of structural inflation, which erodes the purchasing power of your savings. And that combined with the macroeconomic factors that actually cause stocks and bonds to underperform during those dynamics creates the risk of a huge loss of wealth over a structural time frame. And so what should investors do in that? Well, I think the biggest thing that they need to do is to start to figure out how to protect yourself against structural inflation. The vast majority of investors are totally unprepared for structural inflation. So that means holding assets like diversified commodities, gold, frankly, elevating your cash allocation today. You know, cash is paying a decent yield. Buying inflation-protected securities, you know, long-term TIPS, Treasury inflation-protected securities are offering, you know, 1% to 2% real yields. Immunize an investor from the resulting inflation. All of those assets, gold, TIPS, commodities, diversified commodities, all create, you know, that protection to elevated inflation. And frankly, basically, no investors hold any of those assets. And so I think that's, you don't have to put your whole portfolio into those assets or anything like that, but start to build a portfolio that is moving in that direction and you become better prepared for that possible outcome. Because look, if maybe I'm wrong, certainly could be. And let's say something comes in and totally changes the inflation landscape and inflation is lower than ever. You know, we don't have a structural inflation problem. That's fine. You'll get paid on your stocks and bonds if we don't have the inflation problem. The question is, what if we do have the inflation problem? And that's what investors are really unprepared to navigate.
TIPS are indexed to CPI.
They are, yes. That's
right. So something I've always wondered about, and now would be probably a good time to ask it, is how safe are inflation-indexed financial assets really if the index they're tracking is compiled by a government agency that is incentivized to see lower prints during periods of inflation, not just because of financial assets like TIPS, but also government payments like Social Security?
Yeah, there is certainly a long history of misrepresentation of inflation during high inflationary environments in less developed economies.
Which we are now.
What I would say is I think that is always a risk when holding those securities for a variety of reasons. What would happen in that circumstance is that the securities would typically, if that was a structural issue that people thought was happening, the securities would start to trade cheaper. And so your incremental purchase of the security to offset the lying basically by the government. And so, you know, if you're consistently saving over time, you probably wouldn't be affected by it because the market would take into consideration the magnitude of the lies of the government by repricing the assets. But it is a risk for sure, absolutely a risk. One of the things that I think is important to do given that is to have a diversified portfolio of assets that help protect against rising inflation. So as an example, you know, no government can lie about gold, which is a reason why you would want to have some gold in your portfolio in the event that, you know, the dynamic that you're describing happens to occur in a way that is unexpected, or, you know, other physical, a diversified set of physical commodities, things like oil and copper and things like that, which would also do well in the environment that you're describing. So the point is, like, you know, don't go all in on one particular thesis or asset. Protect yourself by using diversification against a wide range of things, even in the circumstance of elevated inflation.
Yeah. Here, risk management. Bob, it was great having you on the podcast. Thank you so much. How do people follow you and read up on your work if they want to do that?
Yeah, for sure. So for those of you who are interested in sort of the blow-by-blow of the macro economy, folks can follow me on Twitter at Bobby Unlimited, where I'm talking about what's going on a regular basis, hopefully giving a little more signal than noise for most people, certainly relative to the conventional media. And then also for folks who are interested in what we're doing at Unlimited, definitely check out our website, unlimitedfunds.com. And there you can find a lot more information about the HFND ETF and see whether it's right for your portfolio.
Awesome. All right. Thanks again, Bob.
Thanks so much for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Me too.
If you want to listen in on the rest of today's conversation, head over to hiddenforces.io/subscribe and join our premium feed. If you want to join in on the conversation and become a member of the Hidden Forces Genius community, you can also do that through our subscriber page. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. You can follow me on Twitter at Kofinas, and you can email me at info@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.